Bill Cundiff. And we have a sponsor this hour, Pepe Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. Pepe has everything you need when it comes to John Deere and a great staff up there. And you go up and see them, and they'll make you a great deal on a new mower, tractor, parts service. They do it all up there. They're located at 3119 Twin View Boulevard in Shasta Lake. Or you can give them a call. Their number is 530-226-9226. And they'll be there all next week, Friday included, right before Christmas. Put a mower under the tree. That'll make somebody happy. Or you can catch them on the web at pappymachinery.com.
Oh, sure. Easy for you to say.
Yeah. It's just a little tricky when you drive them in there. Under, it's kind of hard to hide it. Uh-huh. But, yeah, you can do it.
Considering the things we saw stuck in people's equipment, my snowblower won't work. It's broken.
Yeah.
Oh, it has a spark plug stuck in the
rotor. Yeah, that doesn't work.
You did snow blowing on a spark plug. Not a manufacturer defect. Oh, my goodness. So, let's see. Today is December 18th, 2022, in case we replay this at another time. But just kind of fair warning here, the Christmas lands on Sunday. New Year's lands on Sunday. So we will be rolling archives for the next 2 weeks. And just so happens it perfectly coincides with a major revamp on our website at wethepeopleradio.us. Have to change it around a bit because I've hit the page limit. So anyway, it's going to be converted over. Should look the same, but should perform better, actually. And I'll be able to add some new things, but won't be able to get to that until it's slated to take like probably 3 weeks maybe. So you can check the archives for live shows we do in January. You can just check the archive link, and I'll post it there. I won't be able to create new pages for the shows, but we'll just have to make do. I know you guys are all flexible. So anyway, the information will be there. The shows will continue. Nothing bad has happened. We just had a little – we just ran out of page space.
Yeah.
Simple.
So Nathan's page will be up for 3 weeks.
Yeah, his page will be up like forever. Oh, right. He's like the guy. I called him to upgrade the thing, and they're like, oh, we don't support that platform anymore. Huh? Oh, you'll have to build your site again. I'm like, it's over 500 pages. I can't rebuild the site. Oh, well, we have a guy. They can do it. I was like, oh, thank you.
We have a guy. Everybody has a guy.
Thank God for the guy. All right. So our guest today, Nathan Deschmaker. And he's from, I don't know if he's from Montana. I'm assuming he's from Montana. At least he lives there now. And they raise registered feeder calves in central Montana, just in case you were curious. There's a great picture up on the site, too. You should go look at it. Kind of makes you wish you were there, but it looks kind of chilly. He's a senior research associate and policy analyst specializing in federal and local government administrative procedures, land and natural resource policymaking, local government relations, and program management. Nathan's also an accomplished musician. He doesn't say what he plays, though. We're going to have to have more information on that. And a self-taught theologian with a love for the classics. Nathan has worked with local government to identify and challenge attacks on small farm and ranch operations facing increased pressure and regulation by forces and groups outside of Montana and many times outside the U.S. So before you think, well, this doesn't affect me because I don't live in Montana and I don't raise cattle. Hey, guess what? This does affect you because all of the crazy ideas that the federal government is doing through the bureaucracy, a lot of that, the only way to go after it is through all this administrative procedure failings. I mean, they cut corners, but if you don't know the rules, you can't fight back. So
yeah, unless you like soy burgers and soy fries.
Yeah, and you want to live in a big city.
Yeah,
yeah, great, everybody's dream. So anyway, I think you'll find this really really interesting and full of thought and resources. All right, so Nathan, first we need to know what instrument do you play? Just in case we get all carried away and forget.
Yeah, well, initially the drums, play the drums, but the last 5, 6, 7 years mainly we just playing piano. Did it kind of backwards. They tried to make me play piano in school, and I didn't want to, so I got a drum set and played the drums, and now I'm playing piano. So
they were right all the time.
Funny how that works. Well, good for you. So we spoke the other day about, you know, the wide range of all of this, but I kind of left it to you to steer us on how you want to attack it.
Yeah, well, just on some of your comments for your audience, I guess I can clarify a couple things. One, I am from, born and raised in Montana.
Oh, there you go.
I grew up on a cattle ranch. So yep, that's where I've been most of my life. I have the opportunity to work with people outside of the state in Washington State and other states, Kansas and elsewhere on some of the work that we've been doing on, because like you said, a lot of these bureaucratic rulemaking processes really does affect many, many times, not just one county or one state, but are reach across multiple states. So we've been working in those areas. The reason I got into that, just real quick for your audience,
yes, we had
an organization come into Montana, American Prairie Reserve, over 20 years ago, really, is when they started. But they have a vision and goal of buying up large amounts of private inholdings, and which is privately owned land that is surrounded by BLM, in this case, mostly Bureau of Land Management, federal land. So their goal, just in a nutshell, is 3.5 million acre prairie reserve, removing all the development that's put in place over the years through our domestic livestock industry, and put aside pretty much the same size of the state of Connecticut, right in the heart of Montana, back to passive preservation and bringing bison back, apex predators, and having a large wildlife reserve. So that's one thing, at least in on the Montana front, that shifted my interest and focus in some of the work I do with history and law on understanding how local governments, where we live, if we live in this country, state and your counties or your town, play into serving as a check when our federal counterparts are implementing processes that are coming from outside special interest groups. So that's a little bit of background on how I got involved in some of the policy work in relationship to federal rulemaking.
It's a minefield, though. I mean, it's full of complexity, and I'm sure you've never experienced this. I might have experienced it once or twice, but the agencies will bamboozle you until you bust them with their own rules,
with their own interpretation.
You know, I mean, they'll write their own stuff unless you can kind of stop them.
Yeah, well, and that's kind of the problem, is we've kind of lost ball on there's been a lot of delegated authority to these agencies, and then over time they, like you said, they start putting forward regulations, rulemaking, and all these different things, and they function off policy manuals, guidance documents, and whatnot. And often those guidance documents have departed from the organic authorities that our Congress initially delegated over for those departments. So that's part of what I do, is really understanding the organic authorities, starting really with the Constitution. That's the fundamental framework, the cornerstone of our Republican system of government, separation of powers and the foundations there, and then understanding what Congress has delegated to these agencies, and like you said, coming into that process and bringing them back to those organic authorities. So if you don't do that, they're just moving along, and things, they end up changing law de facto by nobody calling them and checking them on it.
Yeah, that's the part that I think a lot of people don't understand, is that, yeah, a lot of it is rules. Well, those rules have to be rooted in law. They have to have passed a law through the elected representative process. Then the rules come from that. So if they can't show you the law that backs up the rule, game over. But not a lot of people think to ask that. And sometimes it's super complicated and little, you know, Especially, like, I don't know if you want to talk at all about the grizzly bear thing or wolves. We could talk about either one of them. And we see how many corners were cut on wolves.
Yeah, exactly. I'm more familiar personally with the grizzly bear issues in Montana and also Washington State. They actually, right before Thanksgiving, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service put forward a notice of intent to reintroduce a 10J experimental population of grizzly bears into the North Cascade ecosystem in Washington State. And this whole process, we had engaged on this with the Farm Bureau there in some counties the first go-around, because they tried this starting in 2015. And then David Barnhart, Secretary of Interior, in 2020, I believe, terminated that seven-year environmental impact statement due to large local opposition and substantive comment inserted into the record. And this administration, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and the National Park Service have, without producing any new information, no new science, no new data relating to the Endangered Species Act and the bear itself, have decided to throw a notice of intent on the Federal Register right before Thanksgiving, as I said, with a 30-day public comment period for the scoping process. Because when they put out a notice of intent in these processes, that begins the environmental impact statement process, the impacts analysis process under the National Environmental Policy Act. So there's a scoping time frame where there's opportunity for the public and other governments to insert comment and substantive information to inform the scope of what that analysis has to consider and the alternatives that need to be looked at. And in this case, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, the only new information that's come into the record on the grizzly bear regarding the Endangered Species Act were a formal petitions put forward by three states, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming, calling on U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service under the ESA to delist the grizzly bear. So that's the only new information and data and comprehensive documentation that's come in to the record in the last 2 years. And instead of U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, they've missed the deadlines, the 90-day initial deadline, and yesterday was the 12-month deadline to respond to the Montana petition under the ESA. And they haven't even met these statutory deadlines to respond to these state petitions to delist the bear. Meanwhile, they're over in Washington State trying to bring in a non-essential experimental population of grizzly bears in the North Cascade ecosystem. So that gives you a little bit of a picture of how these agencies are functioning and are way off track.
Wow. Well, and they feel like, I mean, you know, I think we've made a fundamental mistake in that we constantly refer to it as federal land. And I had a supervisor up in Siskiyou County who just really got in my face one day. She was a nice lady. And she just got all mad about it. And she goes, "Stop calling it federal land. It's public land. It belongs to us." And I was like, "Okay, you're right.
Good point.
Sorry about that." So now every time I you get ready to say federally, it's like, oh, that's not right. Grace would be very unhappy. It's public. But I think we've forgotten about that. They lock us out. I realize there's a cost to maintain that land. So, you know, you pay to use it. It feels like it belongs to somebody else. And we've kind of given over the control. Which hopefully folks like you will help us get it back. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back with our guest, Nathan Deshmaker. Got the Nathan part wrong, believe it.
What shall we do about them when they move into your neighborhood? They take over, but good. They want you all body and soul. Then it's just your body.
All right, Nathan. Where to now? More grizzly bears? We used to have grizzly bears here, actually, Bill was saying on the break. But we got rid of them. They were too destructive and they were killing everything.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. We have a lot of issues in Montana with them. There's, on the first go-around on this process, we put together a death table, which showed all the deaths, maulings, and killings of grizzly bears of individuals, many of which, some of which have been in our Park Service. And the ironic thing is the National Park Service policy actually says that they will not bring in extirpated species if they pose a direct threat to park personnel or park visitors.
Yeah. So,
which means species that are not currently there.
Yeah, extirpated. So like in California, if there's that would be a region maybe within its historic range, but it's been extirpated for like you said, for pretty good reasons. And that's what's happening in Montana. There's sheep allotments in our, because people are like, well, what's the big deal with the grizzly bears? Well, and you mentioned the public or federal land aspect. So what's happening in Montana is it's not only affecting our sheep allotments and cattle allotments and permittees that are in our Forest Service in these regions around the greater Yellowstone and the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem, but it's also limiting legitimate recreational access and utilization of those lands as well. There, for archery season, there's large amounts of areas within those regions that are prohibited because of the presence of the bear. So instead of mitigating the bear to allow the multiple use and sustained yield and the recreational access and utilization of our federal or public lands, they mitigate the human access and the human utilization of it by terminating cattle permitting and setting time frames that the recreating public can or cannot go in and be in particular regions for hunting, fishing, et cetera.
Yeah,
that's problematic.
That doesn't scream management of public land for the benefit of the taxpayer.
Public. Yeah.
You know, and just so we don't gloss over this, I'm always kind of, I don't know, in the back of my mind channeling the opposition, I guess. And so I'm hearing them say, well, they shouldn't be allowed to use that land anyway, grazing and permits and all that. I know what that's about, and I know a lot of our listeners do, but could you sort of, why is that a good thing, and why does that benefit public land and the public?
Yeah, well, it's a good thing, and it's actually a crucial thing, because a huge, vast expanse of our land, in the western United States in particular, both surface and subsurface mineral estate, is administratively managed and overseen by either the Forest Service, Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. So the rules and regulations and policy frameworks that govern the utilization, access and utilization of the resources that happen to be on all those lands, if we don't have access to those things and the ability to utilize those resources for the benefit, and the Federal Land Policy Management Act specifically says at the out front of that cornerstone statute that governs the administration of those lands, that it is the policy of the Congress of the United States of America that these lands be managed in a way that recognizes a public need for fiber, food, minerals, and wood products. So even our laws, you know, the environmentalists that think we can just leave land there and still have everything that appears on our grocery shelves and the energy that comes into our home to be able to flip a switch and turn a knob on our wall, they're not connecting the dots with the reality of where things materially and energy-wise come from. And much of that in the West, especially in states like Utah and Nevada, but even Montana, we're 35 or close to 40% federally controlled land, not as much as some states, but Utah, the vast amount of the resources that create economic activity and taxable revenue for local governments, for the state. See, that's the thing, is it's not just providing food, fiber, wood products, and material necessities for the population of the nation for national security purposes, et cetera. It's also providing tax royalties and taxable value that, for the most part, local governments are the beneficiaries of. So when they terminate, like Biden did with the XL pipeline in Montana, that pen on a paper terminating that contract for the XL pipeline did away with upwards of $800 million of potential tax revenues for the rural resource-dependent counties in eastern Montana alone, not to mention all the jurisdictions and local municipalities through South Dakota and the other states associated with that. So there's huge problems with saying, well, you shouldn't be able to use that anyways. And for now, unless we let them get away with it, most of our statutory laws and the framework of how those lands are to be administered specifically call for private enterprise in the development and utilization and reclamation of our resources for the needs and benefits of the American people. That's what the law says. That's what the Congress said when they passed over and delegated these responsibilities to our federal departments so that we can still be able to function in the world and in our nation in a way that benefits our neighbor and keeps us in a position, a leadership position in the geopolitical scheme of things as well.
Yeah, because I think there's a mistaken perception that if that land is designated as a national forest, national park, whatever the thing is, that means we don't touch it anymore. It just, we draw a line around it, no one gets to touch it anymore, and it all just manages itself. And out here in the West, that means we have some really big fires.
Well, and also I think they've proven that when we were talking about leasing the land for grazing, taking that out of grazing, the land itself actually benefits from cattle grazing, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, in Montana, not just Montana, but many states, Montana in particular, though, back in the day, early 1900s, there was just in common grazing and utilization of the lands that in some ways was problematic, and you had grazing wars and different things and conflict between sheep herders, cattle, the cattle industry, and different things. And the Taylor Grazing Act came in 1934, and under that act, it withdrew all the federal lands held in the Western Territories from location and entry pending classification of those lands and the best utilization of them. And a lot of those lands were still being disposed of to private ownership and appropriation under the Stock Raising Homestead Act and some other disposal laws. So we need to remember that, too. As much of the real estate was disposed of to private appropriation and ownership, the Taylor Grazing Act, though, there was a huge expanse of lands, 155 million acres, and there's still about 135 million acres to this day that are reserved and classified as chiefly valuable for grazing and the raising of forage crops and have federally cadastral TGA grazing district maps, and through that process over time, there was what developed was an allotment management system, because the stockmen who came in and claimed the 640-acre parcels under the Stock Raising Homestead Act, the requirements for disposal of those lands is, one, you had to be a stockman, and you had to live on the property for 3 or 4 years, and you had to have established permanent improvements. And what happened is that land became what is in law called dependent commensurate property. Because in the West, you know, the homestead laws out east worked well with 180-acre parcels and 640-acre parcels for disposal to private property ownership. Out west in the more arid country, it was not viable for agricultural and economic purposes to have 640 acres of land. So that became dependent commensurate property and was linked to the federal allotments, the grazing allotment system, where those individual, what's called base properties that are owned by individual people in the ag industry, then have grazing rights on those federal allotments. So that has developed over time, and that's been, in some ways, a success in Montana in particular, because we've set up a state grazing district system, statutory framework for state grazing districts pursuant to the Taylor Grazing Act. And we've, so long answer to your question, but yeah, absolutely. Not only just private enterprise and grazing is benefits the land in many cases, but we've developed a rotational grazing system and a process that meets rangeland improvement conditions and other aspects.
Yeah, it isn't just a freeway. You know, people look at it like, oh, well, they're just like cutting the corner and using public land to raise their cows.
stripping the land of anything that's alive, and you know, those grasslands come back every year with grass and not sagebrush and everything else because of grazing. So when you take that out of grazing, if they were to take that land out of grazing, what would happen to it?
Well, that's the problem is, yeah, well, the grasses without grazing would become decadent for the most part. It's just like your lawn. I mean, you need to, grass isn't there just to grow. And I mean, it's in the whole purpose of a blade of grass or a grass is to generate a seed. But, the grazing aspect is a healthy process and a forage process that, is helpful for the range. You leave pasture ungrazed long enough, you know, for a couple years or a year to defer and let it rest is one thing, but to let it sit there and not be utilized for years on end, it doesn't benefit the range, doesn't benefit the grass, and it leads to, just like our forest mismanagement, it becomes just a bigger hazard for fires and other things,
yeah,
as well.
It becomes a massive liability out here, the lack of management. You know, you have people who, oh, we shouldn't cut any trees. You know, the forest will take care of itself. It's like, well, you can't suppress fire and not manage it. You can't do both.
Yep. Exactly. So with the grazing here, the problem here is there, you know, with the American Prairie Reserve, they're not saying we want to stop grazing on all this land. They've bought up a bunch of ranches that are connected, those base properties. They've bought these dependent commensurate properties in the region that are connected to all these BLM grazing allotments. So they may, the APR only owns, you know, the deeded acreage that they have is somewhere around 100, maybe 150,000 deeded acres. But the connection of that to those BLM allotments, they have over 400,000 acres of land. So they're going through permit processes through the Bureau of Land Management right now to transition the class of livestock from cattle to bison, because their goal isn't to remove grazing. They want to remove domestic livestock grazing, but they want to substitute it with this large self-sustaining bison herd. They want to get a 3.5 million acre reserve and have about 10,000 bison roaming out there as a wild. That's their goal, is for a wild population of bison. And so we're engaging on the administrative process on that, because, like I said, the laws and the grazing administration and the regulations that govern those lands, they define livestock, and it's defined as cattle, horses, sheep, burros, and goats. Bison is not among them. The only provision in the grazing regulations that allows bison to be grazed on these lands is a special use permit, and that's an exception to the rule. So, and I don't have a problem with, if the APR was buying just a couple deeded ranches and having some allotments and running bison and managing those bison within the framework, I wouldn't have a problem with that. I don't care if somebody wants to run bison, as long as they follow the process and go through a permitting process to do it, but they don't want to do that. They want to literally subvert the ag industry through the whole region on all these BLM allotments and transition the utilization away from domestic livestock grazing to wild bison.
That seems to be the prevailing sentiment. I mean, if you had to put like a, you know, a header over all of it, it all kind of boils down to, and it's not about people. You know, it's actually contrary to things that benefit humans, typically. So there goes all the food. Goodbye, domestic livestock. We don't need you. We'll be eating, what is it?
That soy.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Oh, joy. The joy of soy.
The Impossible Burger.
Yeah. Yeah, the things that actually use a lot more. I think all that, haven't they already proven that all that fake meat, I've never actually eaten it, so I'm kind of, you know, talking off the top of my head here. But the fake meat actually uses more resources to make than beef.
Yeah, it doesn't make
sense. They've done a whole bunch of work on that. It's just, yeah, it makes no sense. But here it is again. You know, people, I don't think people think sometimes that that you would have all these problems. Although, tell me this. I've got to take a break again. Darn it. Okay, when we come back, has the series Yellowstone helped you or hurt you? Because I'm thinking like it might have helped. It's in Montana. Kind of shows what goes on. We'll be right back with our guest, Nathan Dishmaker. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us. So if they ever make the Bureaucracies a musical, we could just use that for the theme song. Seems to fit, because I tell you what, I deal with these folks too on different issues than you do, but sometimes, I mean, our congressman here wrote a bill. You know, people say, well, it's because the legislation's too big, that's why. All right, he wrote an amendment to a bill. Was for the Army Corps of Engineers, and it said that the Army Corps of Engineers was prohibited from regulating ongoing farming practices. Simple, pretty straightforward. And they were jacking up a farmer here. He plowed his land, and it rained, and some rain got into the little, you know, the furrows that he had plowed on his farm, and they decided it was a wetlands. It's like, no, it's not a wetlands, knuckleheads. So, I mean, the congressman met with the Army Corps and, you know, said, here, this has been signed into law. You can't do this. And they took the little piece of paper and read the one sentence, and they said, oh, yeah, we remember this. But that's just not the way we read it. At some point.
Yeah, I remember that. That was a couple years ago, that case.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, one of the guys that affected is John Duarte, who was just elected to Congress. So I have a feeling he's going to have a special interest in oversight of the Army Corps of Engineers. I'm just thinking.
Just to help him out a little
bit. I'm just thinking that, yeah, that was a really hotly contested race. It was just settled, I don't know, a week ago, maybe, after all this time, and he won by like 600 votes. I mean, it was a toughie. But I'm sure that the Army Corps is like, curses. Here comes Duarte. So, kind of nice. The good guys do win sometimes.
Nathan, getting back to the whole grizzly bear thing.
But I wanted to know about Yellowstone.
Oh, okay. You do that, and then we'll go back to it.
Yeah, because I want to know about Yellowstone. Do you think that helps you guys or hurts you guys?
I don't have much comment on that. I personally haven't watched the show, and I know people that have watched it, and so I I don't know, I guess, whether one way or the other. I know that it's a show that's brought a lot of attention, but like I said, I personally haven't watched any of it to comment on.
Yeah, I guess
mean,
I wasn't
I'm hearing
looking
about it, but
yeah, not like critique of the series or anything, because there's always stuff, you know, people like and don't like and all that.
Yeah.
I just mean it actually I've been fascinated to watch how really kind of accurate they are with how the government and the tribes and the industry and all of that has just lined squarely up on a landowner with the sole purpose of taking his land. They're real clear about it.
Yeah.
And that's happening everywhere. That is not a one-off, and that is not a made-for-TV thing. That is happening all over the place. And I thought, oh, my gosh. Typically, when they make shows about that, you know.
Yeah, the landowner is the big bad wolf.
Yeah, landowner's the bad guy. And in this case, he's not blameless. No. But it really does a good job about how the policy gets skewed. So, sorry.
Well,
back to
in that context, I think it would provide, you know, it's giving a lot of people maybe an eye into some of those issues that landowners have to deal with. Like I said, I haven't seen the program, but like it's just like the farmer down there with the furrows and Army Corps of Engineers saying this is a navigable water, and because you planted a spring wheat crop, you know, we're going to fine you this much a day. I mean, it's just way out of control. In that respect. So maybe the show in that sense, yeah, like you said, it may give opportunity to have a viewing of a lot of people that otherwise wouldn't have a picture of what those things look like.
Yeah, so few people live in that environment. They do, the other thing they do a really good job of portraying is the tie of the people to the land and how well they care for their land and what they think about their land and the history and their animals and how seriously they take all of that. I mean, these aren't people they're pillaging. They're planning on living there for another 150 years. And that, I think, sometimes gets lost, especially in the environmental discussion. They make it sound like, I know here in Northern California, they make it sound like these people have just rolled in out of nowhere. They're going to take everything they can get off the land and then leave. And it's like, well, if they were going to do that, wouldn't they have done that 100 years ago? You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Yep. Well, and on that note, it's good to hear that individuals coming into office or is in office that was associated with that case. Because another thing I've been really tracking is really the systemic problems of just that, of agencies going way off from their delegated authority. And part of the problem is in our courts. Our courts have given broad deference to these executive agencies in interpreting their own statutory authorities. So one of the reasons Army Corps of Engineers responds to your congressman and looking at some statute and saying, well, that's not the way we read that. One of the reasons they're saying that is because the Chevron deference, the Baltimore and Gas deference, the Auer deference, there's a bag of bad case law where the federal courts have deferred to the agencies to interpret their own statutory authority in being challenged, which that's, you know, very, very problematic. But I will say, so I've been reading a book by Neil Gorsuch, published in 2018, I believe. And in that book, and I'm just going to reference this because it ties into what we're talking about, like with that farmer in the Army Corps of Engineers. The book is called A Republic If You Can Keep It. And in that book, he says, on this record, how can anyone fairly say that Congress intended for courts to abdicate their statutory duty under the Administrative Procedures Act and intended to delegate away its legislative power to executive agencies? The fact is, Chevron's claim about legislative intentions is no more than a fiction, and the one that requires a pretty hefty suspension of disbelief at that. And he goes on and says that Chevron is nothing more than a judge-made doctrine to abdicate the judicial responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So we, and this is rolling, this isn't just in a book by Gorsuch, published in 2018. This ties into the major questions issue that is coming before the Supreme Court. The OSHA case triggered the major questions. West Virginia versus EPA triggered the major questions. Social cost of carbon litigation, our state attorney generals are bringing forward, that's percolating to the Supreme Court now, is pressing the major questions. And what is the major questions? The major questions doctrine is when an agency action has vast economic and political significance and is not expressly delegated by the executive branch. At that point, the court no longer defers to the agency, and they look at the statute and they apply the law. And that's what happened in the West Virginia case. That's what happened in the OSHA case. That's what's hopefully going to continue to happen in some of these major questions cases that are coming up to the courts. Because one of the reasons you have Army Corps of Engineers and these agencies saying, well, that's not our reading of this, is because they've been given free rein by the judiciary to interpret its own statutory authorities. Very, very problematic.
Yeah, and that just feeds on itself, because we've seen that, like with the Klamath dams, we've seen it with the Klamath project up here on the Southern Oregon and Northern California side, where when the Bureau of Reclamation makes bad decisions on water policy for water they don't own, that is owned by the people on the project, by the irrigators on the project. But the federal government has acted like it's their water for so long that now it's impossible for the actual owners of the water to get that back. And the courts won't help them. It's in federal court, but they refuse to hear the case. Therefore, the case is decided. You lose.
Well, and the cost of that is... Yeah, so how do you fight that, you know? And one thing we're doing is we're equipping the lesser magistrates in our land, because county commissioners and our local governments really they don't have the resources and the ability and the technical support to be able to traverse the bureaucratic rulemaking process, especially within the deadlines and timeframes that you have to get in there and equip the record. And one of the reasons we're not winning in the courts isn't just because there's some bad case law out there. It's also because we, from the conservative front, have failed to equip the public record. The environmental side, they win so many Administrative Procedures Act cases because they are equipping the record with substantive comment every time the door is open. We conservatives tend to wait till the rule's out the door and they've already done the action, and then we go and litigate on it. And a handful of times we may win on a case if it's big enough and if it's significant enough. But if we're not, so what we focus on, or want to focus on, my focus is taking all this conservatives are putting out excellent information. We have think tanks out there that are developing excellent resources, data, science, legal analyses, etc. But what we're not doing is we're not taking that good information and applying it in the administrative rulemaking process. And that's what we're doing on these federal rulemakings, is equipping the record. We did that in Montana on the American Prairie Reserve Initiative. They opened an environmental assessment for these permits in 2017. And we have equipped the record. We turned what otherwise would be a three-month EA. We did exactly what the environmental group does to us. We turned a three-month EA into almost 5 years now. And now, because of the great work that we did on the ground through our counties and our state grazing districts, we equipped the record so well that when we had a new governor and AG come in, they took the work that we had equipped in the record, and now these permits are now going through federal appeals court. With the full weight of our attorney general's office and our governor's office bringing that forward.
How?
So we don't know what's going to happen in that, but,
sure.
But the fact that we did the groundwork gave a foundation for our state then to step in and continue that forward.
How do, I can hear people wondering, how do regular people do this? You know, like, what's a good resource for people that are thinking, I need to get involved in this, but I haven't got the vaguest idea where to start? And they're all, you know, they're kind of on their own. Are there any good groups to jump in with? Or, you know, you don't have to necessarily give it to me right this minute, but we can post that for people. Because I think a lot of people who live in the rural parts of the country, which is the bulk of the country, not the bulk of the population, but the bulk of the landmass, is rural. Yeah. And they're all being affected by this in some form or fashion. They go to a lot of public meetings. I'm not going to call it a mistake, because it isn't a mistake, but it does wind up being ineffective, even though it's wrong that it should be ineffective. They arm themselves with the science, and people think that facts matter. And these guys mow right over them.
Yeah, well, you have very well-funded environmental organizations and a very well-funded bureaucracy that are paralleled together in the environmental philosophy that's being driven down through these federal rulemaking processes. So how do ordinary people get involved? Well, you know, with me personally, I wouldn't be doing much of what I'm doing. My background's in theology, studying the word, law, history. And, you know, from my perspective, studying the Bible, the Bible is a self-interpreting document. It interprets itself. Anybody can cherry-pick from the scriptures and get a verse to say what it, just like these agencies do. They come in and, oh, here's a statute from NEPA that gives us the authority to do this. You know, when Jesus was tempted in the wilderness by Satan himself and he said, turn this stone into bread, and cited a statute from Deuteronomy that gave him the authority to do that, did Jesus put his hands up in the air and say, oh, you got me. There's the law. What do I do? No, Jesus applied the doctrine of in paramateria, which is that all like-kind statutes are to be interpreted as a whole. And he went to another passage in statute in Deuteronomy and countered it. So that's essentially, that's a biblical analogy, which, like I said, that's where I come from in my, and that's our heritage, by the way. Our laws, because we had Bible-believing Christian men and women that were instrumental in establishing the system of our Republican representative government, our law functions in the same way. The doctrine of in paramateria that was applied in that text is also a doctrine alive and well within our legal system. It's been allowed to go dormant. So for ordinary folks to get involved, it starts with just connecting yourself with the fundamental principles of our system in our constitutional republic, understanding the basic principles of freedom and liberty and life, liberty, and property. You have to start from principles. Otherwise, you get into the bureaucracy and you're incapable of even, you get overwhelmed and you're incapable.
You're ensnared at that point and there's no way out. Let's pick up with that on the other side of the hour when we come back. Because I think that's really important. If you can tie the things that you've been working on to things people might do or might begin to do in their own local place, that would be awesome. You're listening to We the People. We'll be back with you. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Oh!
Who said I see walking in these woods? Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding